On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doug Kirby.
It's a great thrill for me to welcome back to On the Bookshelf someone who's been a guest with us on several occasions. We're talking about Dr. Oz Guinness, who's the author or editor of more than 30 books, including Last Call for Liberty, Impossible People, Fool's Talk, Renaissance, The Global Public Square, A Free People's Suicide, Unspeakable, The Call, Time for Truth, and The Case for Civility. His latest book is what we're going to talk about today, The Great Quest, Invitation to an Examined Life and a Sure Path to Meaning. It's from InterVarsity Press. Oz Guinness is a frequent speaker, prominent social critic who has addressed audiences worldwide from the British House of Commons and the U.S. Congress to the St. Petersburg Parliament, a senior fellow at the Oxford Center for Christian Apologetics, and founder of the Trinity Forum. It is our great pleasure to welcome back to On the Bookshelf Oz Guinness. Welcome, sir. Thank you for making time to be with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be back.
Now, the book is shorter than most of your books that I have read. The most recently, The Magna Carta of Humanity, Fool's Talk, Carpe Diem, Redeemed, and so forth, Impossible People, Last Call for Liberty. This book is a little shorter, but it is an examination of the great quest of humanity. Why are we here? What are we supposed to be about? Does anybody know we're here? Does anybody have anything for us to do? These are some of the great questions that people have struggled with for centuries. And as you say in the book, this is one of the things that separates us from the other creatures that inhabit the planet with us. We're the only people, we're the only animals that say, what's the point of it?
Exactly. Well, this is a relatively simple book. It's a book for seekers. And I think it's incredibly important. On the one hand, you think of, say, young people with the rise of suicides today because there's no purpose and value in their life, or you think of the enormous number of people who say they're religious nuns who now believe in nuns, the biggest picture of all the crisis of the West. You know, the West is a cut flower civilization because it's lost touch with its roots, which are so the importance of how people can think through issues of meaning and come to a solidly convincing position on faith is incredible. Important today. So I've just tried to write a book that shows them how they can think it through.
I think the most important thing about your book is that you set it out for us, first of all, to talk about the quest for meaning and pointing out there are an awful lot of people who just think the whole point is either to amass a big pile of possessions or accumulations or honors, and then when it's over, it's over and there's nothing more to be thought about. But that's not very satisfying to us human beings. We'd like to think that we count for more than just however many decades we get to inhabit the planet, and that somehow or another we'll have some sort of a legacy or heritage that we leave behind us. But if they don't believe in eternity, that's pretty much what they're stuck with, right?
No, exactly. In other words, every human being wants, on the one hand, a sense of meaning. You want to make sense of the world in which we're living. What does it all add up to? On the other hand, a sense of belonging and security in the world. And those sound very simple and profound, but they're very, very important. And, of course, there are many answers on offer today. So what I've described is the stages or phases through which a seeker moves as he or she thinks through what the meaning of life is and sets out all the alternatives. You know, my own thinking went back to the 60s, when I met Francis Schaeffer at the Labrie community in Switzerland, and we had hundreds, if not thousands, of people coming through the community, many of them seekers on the way to Eastern ashrams or whatever, and in lengthy discussions, many, many found their way to faith in Jesus. So I'm hoping this book will be a small version of the same thing.
Now, you've had an opportunity, speaking of Francis Schaeffer, you also had an opportunity to meet some other pretty extraordinary people in your lifetime, some people who have been highly influential, writers and statesmen and so forth, and yet you have not seen knowing them as the epitome of the life. Instead, these were points along the way that contributed to either a greater hunger for understanding meaning or closer to the answers that you were seeking. Am I reading that right?
Oh, you are right. Yes, I grew up, as you remember, as a missionary kid. My parents were medical missionaries in China.
Right.
And were there during the war, revolution, violence, plague, death. I mean, it was an extraordinary time. But I knew Buddhism pretty well, so I wasn't terribly interested in that as I began to think through life. My own journey to faith was a debate between the atheists on one side, Nietzsche, Jean-Paul Sartre, and my hero, Albert Camus, the French novelist. And on the other side, people like Blaise Pascal, G.K. Chesterton, and C.S. Lewis. And I was eventually convinced that the Christian faith was true. And I've never looked back from that. And then going to college in the 60s, where drugs, sex, rock and roll, everything pressed back to square one, you really had to know what you believed, why you believed what you believed, and be able to share it with other people. So all that lies behind. And as you said, I had the privilege of, I've met some great people like Winston Churchill. But in terms of faith, great atheists like Bertrand Russell when I was a student, or more recently Christopher Hitchens living in Washington, D.C., and people like that. So I've tried to always make my faith open to the challenge of alternatives. And yet the more alternatives that I've seen, the more convinced I am of the truth and the depth and the wonder of what it is to know Jesus.
One of the people that you quoted in here was G.K. Chesterton, who's a favorite of mine, too. And he was headed toward a very materialistic worldview and then suddenly discovered the beauty of a dandelion and just the idea that there could be beauty in a world that seemed so dark and so dangerous a century ago gave him hope that there was a light. And if there was a light, what was the source of that light? And you point out that there are people like Chesterton, like C.S. Lewis, that had moments where everything sort of coalesced. But once again, you said, we can't expect to all be blinded on a road to get our attention. For the vast majority of us, it's a long process. It's a figuring out as we go along. And then there is that point when all of a sudden it starts to make sense and the lock turns and we realize, oh, this is what I've been leading up to. This is what I've been led up to, is this kind of understanding.
Mm-hmm. Well, the background to what you're saying rightly is that that's the first section a seeker begins. What constitutes a seeker is a question mark. Until that point, whatever they believe they were happy with, satisfied with, they're not seeking. But it's when someone is shocked into questioning life that they become seekers. And of course, there are various ways that happen. For some people, it's the seasons of life. A lot of people do it in their student years. You know, other people have health crises, or like Tolstoy, facing the challenge of death itself at the end of life. What you're discussing is something I absolutely love. My mentor, Peter Berger, calls it signals of transcendence. Mm. In other words, people have experiences, very deep experiences for them, which puncture what they used to believe and point to something else which would have to be true if it's meaningful. And as you rightly say, G.K. Chesterton, he says he was stopped in his tracks by a dandelion. He knew the world was dark. He was flirting with the occult. But he couldn't deny the fact there was brokenness, but there was also beauty. So the question is, how did you explain both the brokenness, the dark side of life, as well as the beauty and all the wonder of life? And that's what made him a seeker. It was actually a long time later that he became a finder, but that's what set him off. Hmm. And with many people today, we've got to get them moving. Because there are reasons why people don't think. Pascal calls it diversion. People surround themselves with busy, entertaining distractions. Take, say, triple screen gazing on your phone, your television, and so on. People don't want to think.
Right.
Video games can, you know, obsess you for hours. People don't want to think. So the challenge is to get people to think. And that's the first stage, a time for questions.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to Oz Guinness, the author of The Great Quest, Invitation to an Examined Life and a Sure Path to Meaning. It's from IVP, InterVarsity Press. You can check IVP.com to find out more about them. Phase one, times of questions. Phase two is beginning to unearth the answers.
Another reason why it's not overwhelming to have so many positions on offer is that there are only three major families of faiths. In other words, they're a family because they share the same view of what's ultimate reality. And if you see it that way, the three big families of faiths are the Eastern, Hinduism, Buddhism, the New Age movement, very popular in parts of the country today. The second big family, secularist, atheists, agnostics, naturalists, materialists, and so on. And then the third family, which in the West is the Abrahamic, Judaism, and the Christian faith above all. And they have very different answers because they have very different sense of what's ultimately real. So for the Hindu, it's an impersonal ground of being. For the atheist, it's ultimately chance and determinism. And of course, for Jews and Christians, a personal, infinite God who's transcendent, but compassionate and merciful and personal. And of course, the answers flow down very, very differently depending on which family you look at. So that's the second stage. Which answer is the most illuminating and which answer is the most adequate? That's the question for the second stage.
So we start
time
to,
for evidences.
Right. So we start comparing. Really, that moves us rather rapidly into, okay, now that we're looking for answers, we need some evidence, and that takes us to phase three, right?
That's right. In other words, if someone grapples with an answer and they say, this is really illuminating in my question and adequate, then the big question is it true? Are there evidences for it? Now, of course, the temptation today, because we're in a postmodern world, which means many people in today's world don't believe in truth. But actually, truth is incredibly important in journalism, in science, in daily relationships, and of course, in faith. And the Christian faith supremely claims to be true. God is a God of truth. And so if it's true, it would be true if no one believed it. And if it's not true, it would be false even if everyone believed it. So that third question, is it true, is incredibly important. And of course, there's a huge amount written on that, the evidences for the resurrection, and many other examples. That's the third stage of the search.
One of the things that resonates well for me as someone who is an amateur historian, who loves to read about history and to learn about the work of the world through different patterns in our history, is the realization that in the Western world, we understand history as a continuum, not as a circular thing, which is the way they think about an Eastern thought. So that, so that for Christians and Jews and for Muslims, history is an important thing. History becomes a critical thing, doesn't it? And that our faith
Absolutely.
Is rooted in history. So that even our sacred scriptures in the Bible, it will give us very specific time clues. This is when Caesar Augustus was in charge. This is when Cyrenius was governor of Cyrene, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's not just a once upon a time this happened. It's this is exactly when it happened. Now, so you will know that these things are true because these happened at a specific time in a specific place to a specific people.
No, you're describing it wonderfully well. I mean, the Christian faith is not a mythical faith. It happened, as you say, in history. And the Apostle Paul is so clear in that. If the resurrection doesn't happen, we're the most miserable people. Or you take John Updike's famous poem, The Seven Stanzas of Easter. If the very cells did not re-knit and so on, then the church will fall. Because the Christian faith is historical or it's nothing.
Right.
And so the third stage of evidences is incredibly important. Yeah, and a lot of people are rightly talking about faith and science today because of the skepticism over that. But what we need, again, is faith and history, because history is incredibly important, and we're in a huge civilizational moment, although that's another discussion.
Yes. For example, this is something, the idea of there is a reason for things that have happened. There is a guiding force behind them. This is what drew C.S. Lewis. He was a veteran of the First World War, saw combat, lost his best friend. As a result of that, took in his best friend's mother, who apparently was kind of a contentious woman, and yet he did it because he had made that pact with his friend. And he became an atheist, or was really kind of on the way to being an atheist before he even went off to war, according to biographies of his that I read. He was directly influenced by teachers who basically poo-pooed the idea that we needed God. But over time, he kept finding evidence that pointed him toward the truth, and something that you haven't heard, I had not read before, that he was talking to a colleague at his rooms at Magdalen College, Oxford. His fellow Don was well known for his dogmatic atheism, but remarked to Lewis that the evidence for the historical authenticity of the Gospels was remarkably solid. And Lewis was startled, part of because who made the suggestion, and partly because of his own academic discipline. So he began his search, studying the Gospels as a literary critic, and this began to make the difference, and this began to turn his ship, as it were, toward the direction that would be the defining moment and the defining faith of his life.
No, you've described it well, but don't forget the signal of transcendence that set him off. You remember his famous book, too. He was surprised by joy.
Yes.
He was an atheist, as you say, for nearly 15 years, a pretty dogmatic atheist. But he couldn't explain joy.
Yeah.
It wasn't happiness. It wasn't pleasure. It punctured what he believed and pointed to something else. And then, as you say, that crucial time when he began looking into the Gospels. So, you know, his friend said, oh, Jesus, what a great ethical teacher. And Lewis says, no, if you read the Gospels, yes, incredible teaching, love your enemies. But other things which, if not true, would either make him a liar or maybe even a lunatic. Or, horror of horrors, was it in fact true?
Yeah.
And the more he read, the more he was convinced Jesus was not a liar, not a lunatic. And of course, as a literary critic, he knew Jesus was not a legend created by his followers. This was true. And that's what brought him to his knees, as he says, the most dejected, reluctant convert in the whole of England. It wasn't what he wanted, but what he was convinced was true.
So when you find the evidence and you turn that corner, open that lock, then the last phase in the great quest is now what? And the point that you make is, now is the time for commitment. If you've gone through the search, if you've asked the questions, if you've found the evidence to answer those questions, what you have to do with it is take it seriously and make a commitment to the truth.
Exactly. And it's a whole person making that commitment. It's not irrational, but it's more than rational because we are. We've got minds and we think, so it's rational. But we've got wills and we're emotion, and it's the whole of us committing ourselves to faith. So it's not a leap in the dark. I think that's a terrible word. But it is a step of faith, the whole person making a commitment as a whole person. And I tell the story of a European in Kenya, and he was describing faith to an African friend, and he used a word, and the African stopped him immediately. That word's no good, he said. That's like the English word assent. Rather like a hunter with a good rifle can kill an animal of a long distance. He said, our word for belief is the word used by a lion leaping on his quarry and all four legs gripping it in a death leap. That's the conviction of faith and a whole person making the commitment to Christ.
Ooh, that's power. It was your experience, obvious, and mine as well, because we are brothers in Christ, that at some point we felt that we had discovered the truth, that we had the evidence for it, and then came that time to make a commitment. Obviously, part of your commitment has been to challenge others and to make people think about the strength of the bond of Christianity in the formation of Western culture and civilization, but also the fact that even if we didn't have that, the fact that we have this evidence for Christ means we have to do something with it, and we have to do something that will benefit the kingdom in some way. And And I do see a lot of young Christians who have reached that point, and they're trying to find out, what is my place in the kingdom? What do I need to be doing? Mm-hmm. And most of the time, they want to know right then. And they're hoping for, you know, a smoke signal in the sky would be nice. Burning bush is great. An email from God would be great, a text. It's not been your experience or mine that this is always the way that God works.
Well, you know, my book is about the journey to faith, but that's only the beginning of the journey of faith. And as you're hinting in what you're saying, the great thing in terms of when we come to know the Lord, then we have the call of the Lord in our lives. And we have to discover the giftedness that he's given us. And calling is usually a matter of doing what we are. In other words, being the people, exercising the gifts God has given us. And when we do that, then we have an incredibly purposeful and fulfilling life. But that's the journey of faith for the rest of our lives, whereas my book's about the journey to faith.
Right.
But they're
right.
Both very important.
Yes, because once you've made that commitment, then comes that the next phase of your life is, now how do I live that commitment out?
Exactly.
And I realize that's another topic for another book and another time. But
well, I have another book. I don't know if you know my book, The Call.
Yes.
that's actually by far my best-selling book. It outsells the others by a huge way, because the search for meaning is incredibly important, but people long to have a sense of purpose and
yes.
fulfillment.
You make a point in the book about Rodin's The Thinker. Had never particularly considered, and I know it seems like we're retrograding here for just a moment, but it informs me in this progress toward living out the call, in that you point out that you tell the story. Many of us have seen the iconic statue and mostly think it's a guy sitting with his elbow propped up on his knee and looking into the future. But there's much more going on if we look more closely, right?
Yeah, no, as Rodin describes it, you probably have the book in front of you. I don't at the moment. But what's amazing is he says, you look at the thinker, he's thinking with the whole of his body, including down to the way his toes are gripping the rock. And I just make the point, you know, the search is not just some intellectual, you know, playing games, mind games, and having arguments. No, no, no. We are searching for something existentially important because we want to stake our existence on it. And that's what Rodin says the thinker is like. And I love that. People
yes.
thinking with every part of them, because the whole of life is worth it, and it depends on finding the true answer. Now, an important point I make in the book, in some books, some good Christian books, they are an argument. A complete argument. Read the book, and you're convinced or not convinced.
Right.
And what I say is, I don't think that's the way to do it with the search. So my book is not an argument. It outlines the way people search. But the people, in other words, everyone listening, mm-hmm. they have to do it for themselves. So it's a kind of prospectus or a guide or a GPS system for searching. But searchers have to do the searching. And I'm not giving an argument which you take it or leave it. No, no.
Right.
People can read the book, and they have to do the searching.
You're giving them the tools, and it's up to them to use the tools, and it's up to them to decide for themselves what they will make of this. I think it is really, I enjoy your writing very much, and I think it is, without sounding too grandiose about this, but I think this is kind of, if you will, the Oz Guinness version of Mere Christianity, a kind of book that you can give to people who are not do not necessarily consider themselves religious, but they do know there's more out there. They just have to be nudged in the direction so they can figure out how they can make that journey. And that's what your book is doing, is helping them get on the path and keeping them focused as they go down that journey.
Well, that's very kind of you, but that's exactly what I was trying to do. And I hope people will give it to their friends or their kids when they start to have questions and so on. So it's a book for people who are thinking and questioning and searching.
I think it does the job very well, and I can see this being a very useful thing for As a matter of fact, I'm going to get a copy of this for a friend of mine who is the college pastor at our church, because I think this will give him, even though most of the people that are in his college group are already professing Christians, nonetheless, they are going to bring people along with them who are at the very beginning of this journey, that they are the seekers, and I think this will be a great resource for them. Once again, a great pleasure to have you with us. I always enjoy very much spending time with you, and I enjoy very much reading your books and being challenged and charged by reading them. Do you have a website like ozguinness.com or anything like that? Or
yes, ozguinness.com. You can see some of my more recent talks or the whole list of books and things like that. ozguinness.com.
Excellent.
So it's a real pleasure to be with you, and I appreciate it.
Thank you, sir. And thank you again for the work that you're doing on behalf of the kingdom. And thank you for the chance to connect a little bit. I look forward to the next time.
Indeed. Thanks so much. God bless.
Yes, sir. God bless you. Bye-bye. We've been talking to Oz Guinness, the author of The Great Quest, Invitation to an Examined Life and a Sure Path to Meaning. It's from IVP, that's InterVarsity Press. As Oz Guinness mentioned, he was born in China to missionary parents, the great-great-great-grandson of Arthur Guinness, the Dublin brewer. After witnessing the climax of the Chinese Revolution in 1949, he was expelled with many other foreigners in 1951 and returned to England, where he was educated and served as a freelance reporter with the BBC. Since coming to the United States in 1984, he has been a guest scholar at the Woodrow Wilson Center for International Studies and a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution. He was the lead drafter of the Williamsburg Charter, celebrating the First Amendment, and has also been a senior fellow at the East-West Institute in New York, where he drafted the Charter for Religious Freedom. He also co-authored the public school curriculum, Living with Our Deepest Differences. Once again, his books include, but are not limited to, several of the ones I've had the pleasure of reviewing and then sharing with you via BookBits and on the bookshelf, as The Magna Carta of Humanity, Fool's Talk, Carpe Diem Redeemed, Renaissance, Impossible People, Last Call for Liberty, his latest, The Great Quest, and what we might call an evergreen book that he's written and is still extremely popular, entitled The Call, which might be a great combination to get a copy of The Great Quest and get a copy of The Call and have them ready for the same people. So thank you so much for joining us today on the bookshelf and on WTBF, AM and FM, and on my podcast on thebookshelf.podbean.com. We'll see you next week. And until then, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless.